You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
Well, the COVID-19 pandemic has disrupted everything from consumer behavior to supply chain still, and the economic fallout is causing further changes that are yet to be known. The one thing that we hear about constantly is how technology and digital transformation has been speeded up as a result. But how much of this is true, and how much of this is just pure IT hype, oversell and underdeliver? This, as the data analytics field faces a very complicated problem, how to use past data and predict future behavior in the face of uncertainty. It's hard to get any good data about the future, so we have to use data from the past. And if the past is no longer a guide to the future, we're going to have a tough time doing any sort of predictive analytics. Well, to try and pierce the hype and distinguish real change and real value from some of the breathless marketing spin, I'm joined now by Sameer Sharma, who's founder and CEO of DataZoom, a London-based data management consultancy specializing in data strategy and analytics. Sharma hosts the Data Strategy Show podcast, and Paul Morley, Executive Group Data Services at Nedbank. Paul leads a team of data professionals and is responsible for delivering Nedbank's commitments to the various regulatory bodies that govern the finance sector, and has a little over three decades experience in the field. Chaps, welcome to the show. Sameer, perhaps you can kick us off here, because software is never really finished, only abandoned. And I came across this quote recently in a tech-related article, and it's a riff on Leonardo da Vinci's quote, "Art is never finished, only abandoned." How true do you think the above is in relation to some of the digital tools and solutions that are trumpeted every year as the next silver bullet for business?
Well, thank you, Michael, for having me on today. It's an absolute pleasure to be on. One of the things that I often see, and it's a great question in terms of the hype, and software projects are never finished in that sense. Data projects themselves seem to go on and are never finished for that reason. One of the challenges that I see with most data programs, initiatives, and so on is what you've said, the shiny new toy that sits in the corner, that's there, which has been, you know, hyped up several times over and over again. The marketing machine has got into its you know, momentum, and we are carried away with particular buzzwords like, you know, plug it and play and you'll get insights in 10 seconds. Well, we've got to really come back to the type of pragmatic behavior around this. We've got to be simple enough to look at what we need in terms of foundations. And those foundations, I mean, are getting your data in order, understanding where the data is, understanding what the business drivers are before you even go and launch yourself a new AI strategy or, you know, a new AI tool. So thinking about what the business wants to do and understanding how much and how far they can get is a really pivotal exercise that needs to be done before you start investing in the hype that you talk about. And, you know, my colleague Paul and I speak a lot about the hype and the hype cycle, and he's got some great anecdotes about that. So I'll probably hand over to Paul if you don't mind.
And on that point, I mean, it's called the Gartner hype cycle for a reason. I mean, the big consultancy in the space understands full well how these things get hyped, and very often then they fall off the cliff at the other end, either adopted or thrown away as the next shiny bauble didn't work.
Yes.
Well, Paul, from your vantage point at Nedbank, and before we get to the bank's move into the cloud, because you really were a first mover into Azure Cloud, why is it that companies tend to fall into this trap of hyping and believing the hype of the next shiny bauble?
Well, companies fall because it's inherently biased. Okay, and I think it comes back to your point, Michael, and Samir's point around hype. Hype is a business model. Hype is a marketing strategy. Hype is used by consultancies and service organizations to generate business. So that you need to understand that one first. Okay, so it's not always in the best interest of the consumer that we follow the hype cycle. People get lost in this because they've forgotten the origins of hype and how they it's a marketing strategy. So when we look at it, and to me, touch on the side, we have to go back to the basics. The basics is before we start talking technology, and this is where hype sits because they're selling services and they're selling products. This is where the conversation starts, and that is the origin of why we in such a space where hype has dictated the marketplace. Where we should be having a conversation the other way around, with people, process, and technology, and that sort of that sort of construct that is a well adopted construct of building an organization, people, processes, and technology. Hype puts us right at the end. Hype talks about the technology. And we haven't evolved through the people and process. Now, what happens then is we buy the tech and we then try to figure out how we're going to re-engineer the organization. That's the wrong way around. You always need, and again, to hit the nail on the head, you first need to understand what is it, who are you, who is your business, what is your business, where does your business want to go? And here we're not even talking about technology, it's got nothing to do with hype. You fundamentally got to understand yourself. And unfortunately, and there is a bias here, and we see it in data analytics, and Samuel will tell you. It's called backpackers bias. Just because 99 people are talking about it or driving an opinion doesn't make it right. Because the one guy out of 100, he could be the right guy. But humans have a natural tendency towards, the more they hear it, the more they see it, the more they agree with each other. So the 99 people agree with each other, it's automatically assumed that they are correct. And the poor one guy that's standing on the end of the bridge, or on the end of the thing, he's actually right, but no one believes him. Now, this is the danger, okay? Just because you hear it, you see it, you feel it, doesn't make it right. And we've lost that. We've fallen into this trap where these hype cycles, okay, are generating business for the consultancies and the product houses. And in that process, we've got lost. And we see it in the cloud implementations all the day, every single day. People design technology strategies now around product strategies, and they're not the same. And when you define a technology strategy around a product strategy, you're doomed for failure. And we've lost our way in this regard. So this unfortunately is what hype is doing to us. And it's getting worse, by the way. This is not getting easier. And unfortunately, the African continent, being third world, and for that matter, any third world country, is starting to see the effects of this because they don't necessarily have the knowledge and the skills and expertise to understand the difference between a hype cycle and a marketing strategy or a technology strategy. They believe these consultants because they first world.
And I think the challenge, Paul, on that point, and to bounce the ball back to you, Samir, is in an environment where we've seen COVID demonstrate the benefits of working from home and some of the new technologies that for many weren't perhaps that new, but for many were new, operating on Zoom and Teams, it has shown that there are great efficiency gains to be had in moving certain processes and systems to a purely online environment. So we have this big tailwind now that is only going to probably fan the hype cycle flames. So how should companies be thinking about their digital strategies in the wake of the pandemic, considering that there is a lot of hype around?
So one of the things that I always speak about when I walk into any organization is show me your processes. Let's have a look at what the company does. And, you know, understanding the why about the company is really important. And I think one of the things that, you know, the why and the what can kind of come in together. So the way that we see this is understanding the overall context of that particular organization. Where do they sit in? What markets do they sit in? What are the sort of external factors that are being forced onto them? Then looking at the internal view is, how do you match your internal view of your business against the external world and the external forces, whether that's regulation, whether that's, you know, a competitive the competitive landscape, whether that's just market development and so on. And then once they start to understand what's happening externally, they can start to influence the instances or the processes across their organization. Now, this is one of the biggest issues that I see in most organizations. When you speak to them and ask them, can I have a look at your processes of how you operate in today's context, they get very, you know, people get shifted in their seats, and it's a very difficult conversation. If you don't have those processes, how are you going to layer in new digital technologies in order to understand the context, the competitive landscape, and where you're driving against that business strategy in the sort of overall 5 to 10 years. So I think that's really important that they need to start with that. I'm not saying that they need to spend 20 years on getting the processes right. It's being absolutely key about what is the nub of your business and then layering up the idea of data, the idea of digital on top, not just putting that layer on top of the existing processes, which haven't changed for the last 25 years. This is the biggest issue that I absolutely see. You can put cloud in, you can put AI, you can put, you know, RPA, you can put machine learning on top of anything. But again, if you haven't got the solid foundation and it's existing on really old patterns or old data or data that's not really clean or able to drive model development, then we're looking at big issues in terms of how do we make decisions on the back end for when we need to enter new markets or, you know, just being in, you know, in that competitive environment. So those are the things that I think, you know, for me, it's, you know, goes back to what Paul said. If you get your process in place, if you get your people in place and you understand the cultural elements, then you can drive what you're going to be doing. Those two things are hugely important for any organization that's looking to grow out of this COVID pandemic and how they're going to be competitive for the next 10 years.
And it just reminds me of what the banks, Paul, in particular, have as legacy system-layered organizations been grappling with as they look to become digitally enabled is, you know, building on top of these legacy spaghetti systems has proven very difficult. Now, you have moved into the cloud. I think Nedbank was really an early adopter here. What prompted you to move your mission-critical SaaS into Azure with, you know, all the intended cost and potential risks? And how did you weigh that up versus the benefits?
It's always a tough question. I think when you decide to make, and now there are three very highly disruptive strategies. There's data, there's digital, and there's cloud. These three strategies are highly, highly disruptive. And barring data, digital and cloud have the fundamental ability to change the shape and shape the bricks and mortar of the company. That means that strategy can fundamentally change the physical dimension of your company. We're not talking logical structures, we're not talking product, but change the way you work in your buildings, the assets you have. So very, very disruptive. Now, over a year ago, I was looking at all this stuff, and I tackle problems differently to other people, and I'm not scared of necessarily asking, because when this conversation comes up, the question you must always ask yourself, is there a risk? So everybody says there's a risk, but let's understand it. Is there a risk? Is there actually a risk? And if you think about the nuances of what we and where we're going to do, the risk is no different to the risk we have today, because there's a latent risk in our environment already, and that doesn't get changed if you go to the cloud or stay on-prem. But what it does mean is if you don't start adopting new ways of thinking. Now, let's put it this way. And Samir hit on that. You can't just take this technology and strategy and overlay it on legacy and expect it to work. It won't work like that. So you've really fundamentally got to change the way you see the world. Then you can adopt these types of strategies. Because we've had these strategies for years, decades in fact. But nothing here is new. What's fundamentally new is how do we approach the problem? That's new. And there you need to think differently. When we put analytics in the cloud, you know, I sat with my team and they did call me a little bit of a... they said, Paul, I don't think this is right. The guy is thinking in the old world. I don't think this decision is making right. I said, well, if I have. Now, Nedbank's got a very, very aggressive cloud strategy. It's got an 80-20 deployment on transactional in the next 2 years. That means 80% of all our transactional data processing must be in the cloud. That's aggressive. Less than 24 months. That's a lot. Especially considering the legacy you've got behind you in a bank, like you said, Michael. So you know, I know this. It's coming. And then when we looked at the new versions, the new SaaS stuff as an example, and the new strategic partnerships between SaaS, Microsoft, worldwide, I said, well, if you can either do it now or you can do it tomorrow. It doesn't matter. At some point, you're going to have to do it. And you know, and I'd rather be in the front of the queue than at the back of the queue, because the longer you sit in the queue, the more it bottles up and the more it is. Yes, being first has other issues, but certainly you don't have to wait. So when you first, you lead. You develop the best practice. You don't follow best practice. And if you want control of your world, if you want control, be first, because you define it. Everybody else follows you. So it was very important for me in that context to set that stage. Now, let's talk about the benefits. Now, I certainly adopted the cloud in this context, not because I wanted to save money necessarily, because everybody talks about the cloud, which is all the traditional sort of hype, marketing, consulting stuff. You know, Paul, you'll save money in hardware. No, you won't, actually. So you don't, actually. So if you look at, and I'll give you a quick example of this. People say, but Paul, you use the cloud. It's cheap hardware, cheap storage, cheap hard drive. No, it's not, because a well-managed VM on-premise is still cheaper than a VM in the cloud. The hardware is not. So when they say hardware is cheaper, they are right. But they're talking about their perspective, not your perspective.
So where's the benefit?
You don't tell you. So the benefit lies with the capabilities. People miss the capabilities. And if you look at failure rates in cloud, the reason why they fail is because they're looking at it in a traditional way. They think they're going to save money on infrastructure. Infrastructure does not drive your business. What drives your business is innovation at the point of engagement. That's what makes the business a crash. That's where the money is. The money isn't in saving hardware. That, I mean, come on. They say, Paul, you can go to the cloud, cheap hardware, cheap storage. Well, it's cheap. I can, if I wanted cheap storage, I can go out today and buy it and put it on purchase. So it's an irrelevant argument. It's an academic thing. So you need to look at what you don't have when you move to the cloud. What does cloud give you that you never had before? What does cloud give you that you never had the potential to exploit before? And that's where the value is. And if you look at the world in that light, then you will be successful, because it's not about the infrastructure. It's not about these services they offer. It's not about software as a service, a product. Again, that is all irrelevant, because that is an output of the cloud. Like somebody will tell you, the fundamentals of a cloud is data. But do you ever hear a data conversation? Because all the pitfalls of a cloud, or going cloud, is around data. How it's stored, how it moves. They charge you on the ingress cost, they charge you on the storage. So cloud failure projects fail because they never considered the data dimension to the cloud. It's not about infrastructure. It's not about SaaS, and it's not about PaaS. It's not about IaaS. Projects fail because they exclude the data component. And actually, the data is where the value lies. The value doesn't lie in the PaaS or infrastructure as a service or platform as a service or software as a service. That's not the value.
Absolutely.
That's it. If I equated it back to a banking business, PaaS, SaaS, and IaaS, all those things that you hear the consultants talk about, those are channels. It's like the equivalent in a bank would be ATM, would be internet banking, would be phone banking. That is the equivalent of a cloud. So in cloud's perspective, their channels is IaaS, PaaS, and SaaS. But the business is behind that. The business lies behind those channels. And people miss that. They build the business case and they build the ideals around the channel, which is the front end, IaaS, PaaS, SaaS, and all of those fancy services they put. They build their strategy around that.
Samir, what do you make of Paul's approach at Nedbank in cloud adoption and really saying that it's not about the marginal benefits on hardware savings, but really the benefits of extracting that value from being able to have your data analyzed in the cloud? How many businesses get this wrong?
Firstly, I think it's absolutely bang on and spot on what Paul said. Most organizations focus on that downstream technology component. What they're not focusing is on, you know, and I'm going to say this word, monetization effect. So a phrase. Monetization isn't such a bad thing in terms of what we do. It's the getting the value out of data, providing different services to our customers, ensuring that we can understand what our internal cost savings are around specific products and the way that we drive analytics internally. But essentially, what we're talking about here is how do we get the biggest bang for our buck from that data at the edge, where the customer is, and how do we start to offer them a different type of service? And I think that's what Paul has done extremely well in terms of the cloud data and digital strategy. And you know, those things are very difficult for organizations to do. One of the things that I think Paul's mentioned that he's done is absolutely understand what you don't have. Here's the thing, you know, you look externally and look at everybody at what they're doing. You should be looking at what they're not doing. And I think that's an extremely important aspect to what Paul's mentioned in his cloud strategy, in Nedbank's view on how they accelerate value to, you know, from getting into the cloud and analytics in that space. So I think most organizations are stuck in a very, what I would say, caught between a rock and a hard place around how do we concentrate on getting value from data, but trying to get this cloud strategy in. And they are focusing more on the cost savings in the back end. What they're not doing is looking upstream and saying, how are we going to build better products? How are we going to lean on that data and understand exactly at that moment what the customer needs are? This is something that is you know, talked about widely in the industry, and many organizations don't absolutely get that right. So today, you know, we work with many organizations that are looking at they'll come to me and say, you know, we're looking at an AI strategy. And I say to them, well, what is an AI strategy? Why are you thinking about an AI strategy? You should be absolutely thinking about what's the business strategy and how are you going to apply that over X amount of years, and what are the levers that you need to pull and push in order to drive and accelerate that business strategy. Could be cloud, could be digital, could be data. But it's, you know, all of those things are elements of how the business is going to be driven. The biggest component I think that's missing, Michael, and Paul probably has not touched on it, but probably will in terms of a Nedbank view, is culture.
Yeah.
as we start to really drive these new ways of working, we need to look at how the culture is evolving as well.
How do you put the people in the front of that people, process, technology equation? Samir, just to cut you off because we are rapidly running out of time. Paul, how have you done that at Nedbank? Because clearly, by taking a first mover lead, there is a first mover advantage. There are also school fees that you're going to be paying as that first mover. So talk to me about the culture and the environment that you created inside the bank in order to do that. And also share some of the lessons and the school fees that you've had to pay as being a first mover into the cloud.
Yeah, I think, and again, you're dealing with people. Okay, so people don't like change. Inherently, they don't like change. That's the bottom line. People do not like to change. They like to live in the comfort zone. They like to live in the status quo for the most part, and they just want to tick on. That is the basis of being human. Let's all face. Let's all be honest. They don't like change, and there's very few people who enjoy change. I'm one of them. I love change. If you put me into a room and you let me do the same thing for 2 days in a row, I go mad. I have to. It's got to be something different every day. How I approach it. And again, this is not about the big parts of the organization. Culture starts at the smallest elements of the organization. People think with these big, massive change cultural programs, massive. They spend millions on consultants to go change and assess the cultural setting. That's the wrong way to do it. Your culture changes at the ground level. And what me and my team said, I said, look, guys, this is a big ask, okay? And we need to understand. This is like pioneering through the jungle of Borneo. You are the first guys. You've got to panga your way through this jungle. You're going to be bitten by snakes, stung by mosquitoes. You're not going to have water. It's going to be terrible. But behind you is a very clear road. So the second guys are going to have a much easier job. But I also said we also need to look at developing skills we don't have. So the way I've changed it with my team is, I said, we need skills. We need skills. The skills we have, we don't have. And I'm talking about skills around adaptive learning, faith, a positive outlook. I'm talking about all those soft skills. And I said, this is the way we're going to do it. Because the cloud changes everything in your perspective. You don't have the skills. You don't have the understanding of the technology. You know nothing. So now everybody's equal. There is no one guy better than the other guy. And we agree. We're going to run. We're going to do this. And we all agree at the lowest level of the organization, not the highest, the lowest. We want to take this challenge on, and we believed we could do it. Maybe we wouldn't have. Maybe it was a risk. Maybe I was this particular program was a moonshot, 1 in 100. Maybe it was that. Maybe it wasn't. So we adopted let's run. And the attitude we developed was we banned words like no, can't do it, I'm skeptical. So all of those negative words we actually banned from our vocabulary, and we're only allowed to talk in the positive context. So it's we can, we will, we should. And as soon as you remove that negativity out of your language, you'll be surprised how quickly your actions change. Because and I think this is the secret. So if you remove some of the fundamentals, the basics, then your culture's. And we were lucky. We had a team that drove hard. And the fact that the team was very complex. We had two Microsoft teams, one local, one international, two SaaS teams, one local, international. So it was about five different teams. Working in three geographies and time zones, and we work 24 hours. So from a geo perspective, very complex. Five teams, three geographies, I think four or five time zones, and we did it. And simply because we all believed, we said we're going to do it, and we did it. So cultural change starts with an attitude. It starts that you can. You can't change a culture if your people don't want to change culture. And that's the lesson now that I give people when they want to change culture. Yep. If you're going to change and shape the culture, what you need is the people wanting to do so. You cannot enforce cultural change. It doesn't work. Yep. So you've got to somehow find a way where you can convince the lowest level of your organization that this shift is required. And if you get that right, the cultural question becomes irrelevant.
Absolutely.
Because they will adopt it and they will drive it. They will drive it for you without you asking. They will drive it.
And Paul,
you've got to have their backing.
On that
it can't
point,
be enforced.
I mean, and on that point, I think it's an important point to make. And Samir, with 30 seconds to go, the fact is leaders, CEOs, managers of teams have to embrace this role as communicator and collaborator to drive the change that's going to cut through the inertia that stops these projects from getting off the ground.
Yeah, Michael, it's a great point. I think the idea that we over-communicate is, you know, we have to continuously communicate the benefits, the reasons why we're doing it. But this is not about, say, putting a stakeholder matrix together. This is about rolling up your sleeves, getting into the areas which have this skepticism and starting to break down those conversations, really driving it down to that level to say, why is it that we don't want to do something? What are the reasons? Getting to understand people is the dimension that we often miss. And that's the bit which I think is, you know, we just layer it on top of them and say, here's what you've got to do, another piece of change, another piece of change. But really understanding the drivers, the benefits, the, you know, getting under the skin of that individual just to say, how do you see the world? You know, where do you come from? How does it work in your in the way that you sit within your processes? How do you do the handoffs between you and different people in the organization? That's an important aspect about how people work culturally. If we don't understand that, we can't weave all of these technologies and AI and machine learning into their everyday process. That's the bit which we're missing. Yeah. And quite rightly, we should be looking at that supply chain of events that occurs and helping people to understand seamlessly that bit of data you need to trigger a decision comes up right there and then, instead of you having to switch on three different systems to understand it. That's the bit that we're missing.
And using that data to then lead the transactional side of the business, as I'm hearing you say as well. Thank you very much, Sameer Sharma, founder and CEO of DataZoom, and Paul Morley, executive for Group Data Services at Nedbank, sharing their lessons and distinguishing between the hype and the real value that's to be had in a data-led, fully digital and cloud-based strategy.